This week on Writers, Inc.
I think that's also like a big thing I come back to over and over again is how can I make it worth the reader's time? And how can I, even though I'm not really writing for stage anymore, I will never lose that feeling of if I'm going to create a character, if I'm going to write, you know, a scene or something like that, someone's got to show up to be in that role. Someone's got to, like, you know, memorize these lines. Someone's got to book a space. So there's just always this feeling of, like, it's got to be worth that. It's got to be worth this effort and time.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So we finally got the hardcovers for Something I Keep Upstairs, which I am very excited about. Yeah, they came out awesome. Did I tell you guys about the issue we had with the cover?
No.
I don't remember if we talked about this on the air. So the initial print run, they did 5,000 copies, and they sent the first 5,000 to Simon & Schuster. When they opened the box at the warehouse, somebody opened it up, and they read the description of the book on the inside flap. And the very first word is in. And somebody doubled the I's. So it had I-I-N just I-I-N on the first 5,000 copies. So we had to reprint 5,000 jackets, and some very unlucky person over at Simon & Schuster had to pull the old jackets off and put the new ones on. But their schedule is actually very tight from a printing standpoint. So by doing that, like, we almost had to put the publication date back because they weren't going to be able to deliver the hardcovers in time. Luckily, they got it all done, but like it cut it really close.
Wow.
Yeah, that would not have been good pushing the pub date back.
I couldn't do it. I mean, not with the release party is already on a specific date. Yeah. You know, like, there's pre-orders already in. Like, if you try to change your publication date on like Amazon or something, like, they drop all those pre-orders, so you've got to start over.
Yeah.
So like it wasn't an option. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, you know, like the book description, you know, like that was approved so early on, you know, the covers designers, they had it very early on. So it's just a copy and paste in there. So like none of us were even looking at it, you know, by the time we got to the final stages on the cover, you know, we're looking at everything else that's new, not something that, you know, we came up with 6 months ago. So it just completely slipped by.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I have an error copy? Because it'll be worth something later. Can you send me one?
Yeah. I don't know what they did with them, but yeah, I actually want those. And I'm not sure. I'm guessing they destroyed them. Like I haven't actually seen one.
They're pulp now. They're new books at this point.
Yeah, they probably are. Yeah.
Well, it was just the cover. Right? It was just the sleeve part, right?
Yeah, it was just the jacket on the hardcover.
Jacket. So that's the word I was looking for. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So they pulled the jackets off, put the new jackets on, and then put them right back in a box to ship them out.
At least that's cheaper. I mean, it's, you know, it's a lot more expensive to have to redo like the entire book for a full run.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. No, this even still, this came out to, I think it was about $3,000.
Yeah.
Start to finish, just to fix one letter that showed up someplace it wasn't supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know, and like they gave me the option to like just let the first 5,000 go with the error, you know, which I guess we could have done, but you know, I know me as a book buyer, if I pick up a book and it's got a typo on the, you know, the book description and literally the very first word, that's a problem.
Just consider that a kind of marketing expense that, you know, because it would be bad marketing for it to go out with the typo. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a negative marketing experience.
Well, I already did the let me speak to your manager thing with my cover design company, and they gave me a credit for the cost of the fix. So in the end, it's all going to come out in the wash.
That works.
All right, Kevin, what is in the news?
Let's look at the news. So TV writing jobs fell by 42% in 2023 to 2024 season, WGA says. The Writers Guild of America has released troubling new statistics indicating a significant drop in television writing jobs, with a 42% overall decline from the 22-2023 season. The decline in TV writer employment is attributed to several factors, including the rise of cord cutting, the decrease in cable TV subscriptions, and the volatile dynamics of streaming services under pressure from Wall Street and to turn quick profits. The WGA strike from May to September of 2023 further exacerbated the issue by shortening the TV season and reducing the number of series produced.
Yes, we're going to start feeling this, I think, across the board. You're going to see a lot of, like right now there's so many shows coming out, and like that's going to dry up very quickly. The strike already hurt, and like the thing they're not talking about is the fire in LA. So many writers got displaced because of that. So that's hurting things too. They've just gotten hit with a perfect storm. But yeah, honestly, I mean, the revenue is just not there anymore. If you think of a movie 15 years ago, it would come out as a feature film in the theater, so they got all the money from that. There was no other way to see it. Then it would come out as a Blu-ray and DVD in the rental market, so they got all the revenue from that. So they were really able to line their pockets, and before it ever got to the point where it could be considered, streaming. And back in those days, that was it's going to show up on Showtime or HBO or something else. But then they paid a big licensing fee, and those licensing fees were still way more than what the streaming services are paying today for those same products. Then you factor in COVID and people, basically decided they don't need to go to the theaters as often. So a lot of theaters closed, so like that revenue's dried up. But if you get a chance, just pull up like release data on movies and just look at how much money a movie is bringing in today versus 15 years ago. And it's night and day. It's pretty scary.
Well, and this is specifically TV. I don't know that it's necessarily talking about film in this. I mean, there's still that's all over the place. But what this does do is it kind of helps decentralize what's been happening in the studio system for a while. And I think what you're going to see is like the people who are going to fill this void are the kind of independent producers that are out there. I mean, there's a lot of stuff happening. Look, just in Atlanta alone, that is independently produced, and I think you're going to see a lot of that kind of content. Netflix already sort of leans in on independently created content, and I think other streaming services are probably going to do the same. And then you've got like Apple TV; they produce all their stuff in-house, so they're working off theirs. They still have their subscription model. They do all their own internal promotion and everything. They own their list. So it's that one's a little more, I guess, it's they're in an isolated little bubble, the same sort of Apple walled garden system. So I feel like this is going to open up opportunity,
Yeah,
basically.
I've been holding out on the Apple subscription because I have so many of them already, but
Yeah.
maybe I'll break down now. I saw they have Murderbot, so I'm
Yeah,
crying
I'm
about
interested
missing
in
that.
Oh, yeah, that one's gonna be good. Apple actually, I think they have quite a lot of shows on there that are pretty good. Amazon seems to be getting better after, but I think they bought MGM Studios, if that's right.
That's why I'm stockpiling my Wheel of Time episodes, waiting for the writer's drought.
Well, I think they're all approaching it kind of in the same mindset. They're thinking, why are we paying licensing fees when we can produce this content on our own? So they're taking the money they would have paid a production company, and they're basically creating the content on their own. But what's really happening is all these numbers are shrinking. So like the less movies they buy, that means the less movies are going to be made, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy kind of thing. That number gets smaller and smaller year after year. And Kevin, you're right. Like there's more independent stuff getting produced, and it's getting produced on the cheap. And it's, if you do it right, it's competitive. But if somebody's making a movie for $100,000, and that's what Netflix decides it wants to show for now on, then they're going to limit what they can spend on the big studio purchases and licensings, and that's going to cut that too. And I mean, before you know it, everybody's just making movies on iPhone or with AI, which is really what they're going to have to double down on because it's the only way to offset that cost. So.
I, for one, support this.
So speaking of keeping things in-house, I think that's what our next article is about too.
A new chapter for publishing? Question mark. Book subscription services launch their own titles. Some book subscription services, such as Fairyloot and Owlcrate, are transitioning from just distributing books to publishing their own titles. This move is seen as an effort to address issues within the traditional publishing industry and leverage their deep understanding of subscriber preferences. The entry of subscription services into publishing could mark a significant shift in the book industry, similar to how streaming services have changed film and television by producing original content. This could potentially disrupt traditional publishing dynamics, but also raises concerns about the loss of the magic of discovery that subscription boxes offer.
This is interesting. I was reading more into this as Owlcrate is Canadian and traditionally were kids, but now they're doing adult sci-fi, fantasy, romantasy. You don't need an agent to submit. And I'm just like, they're going to start prioritizing their own books for
Yeah.
that subscription service. So,
Yeah.
yeah.
mean, it's the same as what we just talked about, right? Just a
Yeah.
different media.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's interesting because they do have a base, but it's also those subscription boxes tend to, I mean, they did do like author discovery for debuts and stuff, but they also tend to, a lot of the special editions like are big authors, so it's sort of hit or miss. Like I know that there's a lot of grumbling and like subscription box like the communities because they tend over the years to do less and less like new debut discovery authors because those are the boxes that people tend to skip. They don't want them as much. They want the big names. So,
What they need to do is a kind of pairing thing, like a curated
yeah.
pair. So, like, John Grisham comes out with a new Camino Island book, and we tack on one of Kevin Thompson's, I'm
Yeah, yeah.
just to throw a couple of names out there, but
That's good for
that's
debut authors.
similar.
Yeah. We all would
Yeah.
like that.
But I have also noticed that there's a lot of book clubs now coming out too, where you subscribe for like, $30 a month, kind of like a book of the month, but you don't get to pick the book. And, it comes with author interviews and, different resources. And there seems to be more and more and more of those popping up lately too, which I think is kind of interesting. It's a little bit like a subscription box,
Yeah.
but
And
not.
yeah.
But social.
Any idea where they get the books for that?
So the ones I've seen, they tend to be traditionally published books. And I think that whoever is like the, they tend to be like I know RuPaul has one, and
Hmm.
so and then another big bookstagrammer, Jordy. I don't know if anyone follows him on Instagram, but so he has one now. Yeah. And so he selects the books, and then that's the book recommended for the month. And if you subscribe to like his book club, you get that book. And then that month they do like Instagram lives. And I think they have an author interview that you get to. I don't know what platform they use, but you get, I don't know if it's a video, I don't know if it's like a Zoom call, I'm not sure how it's structured, but just a lot of different like resources and stuff.
As a publisher, like I'm looking at this thinking, I could do bulk discounts, I could do
Yeah.
licensing agreements, if they've got 500 members in their book club, like we could work out a deal,
Right.
50% off on the hardcovers or something. And I'm sure I'm not alone in that. So they're probably talking to publishers
Yeah.
about that
Yeah.
and bypassing a
Right.
part of the market.
Yeah, that would be fun though, as an author though. Like, yeah,
Yeah.
show up and drink your glass of wine. Flatliners and Jordy's book club. Let's go, JD. We can do it.
Yeah, he does. He does like a lot of horror. Like his just started. I guess that's why I know about it, 'cause there was a lot of advertising on it, and he started January, and it was Grady Hendrix's new book. And so every month he just picks a new book. And
Yeah.
but yeah, it's kind of interesting, all these different things that are coming up. I like it.
All right. Well, we got one last news story. Let's dive into that one. This is how Meta AI staffers deemed more than 7 million books to have no, quote, economic value. Documents in a major copyright suit against Meta reveal that while the tech giant determined that books were essential for building their data models, their defense also hinges on the argument that individual books themselves are essentially worthless. That is, any one book's presence in or absence from the model is inconsequential, but the aggregate value of the thousands of books Meta allegedly pirated to train its LLMs is immense and irreplaceable. You can't make the whole without the parts, but since the parts are apparently interchangeable, Meta doesn't think it should have to pay for any of them.
I was just mad.
I guess if you've got to defend theft, like there's only so many arguments you can make, right?
Way to win us over, Meta. We're fully on board now.
I was like, but it's in the documents. quote, essentially worthless individual books. So I was angry. So I just had you to get you all angry with me too.
Yeah, essentially worthless. Well, go ahead,
They
Jim.
really have no defense for what they did, right? So
No.
it's like
Yeah.
all you can do is come up with whatever your best defense is. And if this is their best defense, good luck.
Yeah.
But
When you have no ground to stand on, you have to make everyone else look like they are, pathetic losers with no value. That's
yeah, I mean,
really.
every book in there has a price tag on it, whether
Yeah.
they stole ebooks or they stole print or whatever, like there's
Right.
a value that can be attributed to every single book that's on that list. So I don't see this flying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll
No.
be
Yeah.
watching this one because if the court passes this, then I'll be angry with the court instead of Meta.
Well,
So
I'm going to change my tagline on all my books to essentially worthless.
That's a great name for an autobiography.
That's it. Yeah, there's
Oh, that is. That's actually hilarious.
one more for my list. I've got a
Right.
growing list
Yeah.
of autobiography titles.
Essentially
Oh, I love it.
worthless.
I just want to see like the titles and fake covers on your social media for all your autobiography
I
on your
should do
fake
that.
campaign.
Just once a week release. My upcoming autobiography, essentially worthless.
What a great blurb. Just put the, put essentially worthless in quotes and then put like meta, just like attribute it, like use it as a blurb.
Just use it as a blurb. I love it. Yes.
This book is worthless. Essentially worthless.
Hey, this is Kevin Tomlinson. It seems to me like you might need a little help. Maybe hand off all that stuff that's keeping you from writing. At Author Anchor, we connect authors with skilled, affordable virtual assistants trained specifically for the publishing world. Your personal VA handles everything from book production to marketing and social media, freeing you up to focus on what matters most, your writing. Book a discovery call today and we'll find that perfect VA for you. Plus, mention the Writers Inc. podcast and you'll get $50 off your first month. Visit authoranchor.com and get matched with your personal VA so you can just write.
Okay, JD, who's up this week?
This week we've got Nat Cassidy coming on. Nat's an American novelist, actor, playwright, and musician based out of New York City. His latest novel is called When the Wolf Comes Home and releases April 22nd. Here he is, Nat Cassidy.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today. I'm very excited to have you on.
I'm so excited to be here. This is such a pleasure. I'm a big fan of the show, so I'm glad to
Nice.
be here. Yes. Hello,
Yeah.
everybody on the other side of the interview segment. I hope
Yeah, on
you're
the
all
other
well
side.
too.
Nice. Yes. Well, yeah, so we're going to talk about your book and we're going to just have a nice time. But first, we tend to dedicate this towards writers and readers, but writers. And so let's go to the beginning. What is your writer origin story? How did you get started writing?
Oh man, how much time do we got? I don't know. It's always been just one of those things. My life was always kind of set on two parallel tracks, like from a very early age. I'm talking like 5, 6 years old. I knew I was going to be an actor and I knew I was going to be a writer. And for the longest time, they were very parallel. Like those two never intersected at all until like this is probably going to be obvious immediately, but I was a really precocious kid, like aggressively precocious. So there was at least one point, like when I was probably around like 10 to 13, where I was like, maybe I'll get to star in the inevitable movie adaptations of my work. But
Of
that was like as
course.
close as I ever got to like combining the disciplines. And I don't really know where they came from. Like I think in a way they were both grounded appropriately enough to the conversation I'm sure we're about to have in a like deep visceral fascination with the macabre. Like I was always a really macabre kid. I loved horror. My two biggest passions from about as young as I could have passions were Stephen King and Shakespeare, which they kind of still are to this day. So from like, yeah, and like they were very intertwined in a really real way for me. Like especially in the 90s, I used to get a lot of flack from people because I would compare the two all the time. And that was like when Stephen King was like at his critical nadir, but I was like, no, he's just like Shakespeare. And then I would passionately make the case, which I will spare you from.
Well, now I
Both of
might want to
those,
hear this case.
yeah, I could probably pull it out. I'll spare you for now then.
Okay.
But yeah, so like I was just, I loved monsters and ghouls and ghosts and things that scared me, and I really wanted to write stories that, you know, basically were at that point egregious Stephen King ripoffs, like to the point where they were all set in Maine, and I still to this day have never been to Maine. I grew up in the desert. I grew up in Arizona, so about as far from Maine as you could get. And then like my love of Shakespeare also came from it was a first grade teacher who I hated and who hated me because I was, besides being a precocious kid, I was a nightmare kid, like setting fires in the back of the room kind of kid.
That's the aggressive part of the aggressive
Yes,
precocious.
very. I was precociously lighting fires. I was. No one could light fires as well as me. But this first grade teacher basically dared me to read Macbeth one day when she was showing
In
slides.
first grade?
Yeah, in first grade. She was like, "You think
Wow.
you're so smart? Let's see if you can get through this." She was showing slides to the class. She was Greek. She was from Greece, and she had just been to Greece for a vacation. And she was showing slides to the class of like, you know, what she'd done on her trip. And one of them was an amphitheater, and she'd seen a production of Macbeth at this amphitheater. I don't know why she started telling a bunch of like 6-year-olds the plot of Macbeth, but to
Yeah,
her credit, yeah, I know, like she's not innocent in this too. She was also pretty macabre. But to her credit, she noticed that like I stopped like stabbing things with a knife and like was paying attention to this tale of witches and regicide. And she like basically challenged me to follow through on my obvious interest. So both of those passions, both of those disciplines started from a place of like I like spooky things, and it got me to like pay attention and stuff like that. And yeah, so it wasn't until like my 20s where like this is all very long answer to the origin story question. I apologize. But there are multiple
Wildly
ingresses.
entertaining. Please
That's
continue.
all I can hope for. It wasn't until my 20s that I moved to New York to pursue classical acting, appropriately enough. And then I was doing that for a couple of years. And then I was like, wait a minute, I kind of hate classical acting. I don't enjoy the scene. I don't enjoy the professional track that it puts one on. And so I was like, I've been reading scripts my whole life and I've been writing short stories my whole life. What if I just start writing plays? And so that's when I kind of started writing horror plays, and my playwriting career took off way faster than my acting career at the time, which I try not to take personally. And so that's like really the origin story of me as like a professional writer. That's when I started writing like kind of as a focus. And then like a few years after that, after, you know, pursuing being a playwright for about 10 or 15 years, and making the shocking discovery that you cannot make a living doing that, I was like, oh, I should maybe go back to writing short stories and novels again. Like, you know, at least then I wouldn't be begging people to come to a thing that's only going to exist for a few weeks, and I can just like set these things down and you know, be able to hand them to someone and say, read this on your schedule, not on the schedule of the theater in Brooklyn that where the trains are shut down. Yeah, so that's kind of led us here today.
Wow, that's quite the story. We're gonna have to come back to Macbeth in first grade
Oh yeah.
after this interview, obviously. But so you shifted. How did you go about getting your agent? Was that, did you cold query? Did you just happen to maybe have like connections that you made through your playwriting world? How did that come about?
I love this question, and I love to talk about this sort of stuff because so again, I was a playwright for like 15 years and was by most metrics doing pretty well. Like I got really great reviews, I got really great audiences and stuff like that. But it seemed like I had hit like this invisible sort of ceiling of some kind. And you know, like the like high profile playwriting opportunities seemed like just out of reach. Like I would occasionally get like a good you know, writers group, an off-Broadway writers group or something like that. But then like the next step was always just tantalizingly out of reach, including representation. Like I could not get representation to save my life for 15 years. Just like, you know, I would reach out to agents and be like, I have this Lort contract for a regional theater contract that pays good money for this play of mine? And they'd be like, okay, we'll look at that contract for you. And then I'd be like, will you also be my agent after that? And they'd be like, nah, we don't want to continue that relationship, you know, so officially yet. So it was just like this, like, ad hoc, really frustrating, like, why won't anyone commit to me sort of thing. I had a couple of other speculative fiction genre playwright friends who were in a similar position. Like, some of them had representation, but we were all kind of reaching that same crisis point of, you know, it's just impossible to make a living as a playwright. Every time you put up a play, you're starting from zero again, begging people to come and see it. You can't refer them to something you did in the past because it doesn't exist anymore. You know, the Times is only covering like one of 10 of us at a certain time. So it was just like, it was so frustrating. And one of them was a brilliant, brilliant writer named Mac Rogers, mainly like was writing like sci-fi and, you know, occasionally like crime plays and stuff like that. But he'd started to make a name for himself as an audio dramatist, and was writing for podcasts. And some of these podcasts were doing gangbusters numbers.
Wow.
And so we were like, why don't we kind of pool our resources together and start an audio drama company together? And we did that. It's called Gideon Media, that is still running to this day, doing amazing, amazing work. Our first like maiden production was a script of Max and Tor, who is, you know, headquartered in New York, the great genre publishers. They would come and like see our plays a lot, like a lot of the like a couple of editors and people on like at tor.com and stuff like that would see our plays and they loved them. They would occasionally like review them on the blog, but you know, they were like, we can't do anything with you guys, like we're fans of you, but like we publish books and you guys write plays, never the twain shall meet. But they also wanted to get into the audio drama space. And so the timing was really fortuitous. I promise I'm coming to answer your question. It's a very long story. It's winding road, but for a reason. So they decided to co-produce this first production with us. So Tor, under the auspices of what was called Tor Labs at the time, and Gideon Media did this co-production called Steal the Stars. That was like a sci-fi, noir, heist, doomed romance sort of 14-episode story. And they were like, hey, now we can kind of work together a little bit under you know, our bailiwick. We want to do like a novelization of Steal the Stars to be released concurrently with the final episode of the audio drama. And like, you know, you guys are busy, you know, making the podcast and being in the podcast and writing the podcast. So like we can do this on our own, but like this will be like a nice sort of tie-in event. And I was like, this was right when I was like, maybe I kind of want to get back into writing books and stuff like that again. So I was like, ooh, can I like audition to write the novelization? And they were like, yeah, sure. You know, write us 20,000 words and we'll see how it goes. You know, no promises that you'll get the job, but if it works out, it works out. Great. And so I did that. And like Mac was still writing the first draft of this. Like we had no idea where this thing was going at this point. And I was also in it and helping produce it. So it was very like nose to nose. We were all kind of working on this thing in a very tight time frame. But I wrote the like 20,000 words, which is like the first three episodes or something like that. And I gave it to the editors at Tor and they were like, great. Like, you know, you actually can like write in prose. So you can have, if you think you can finish this, because the turnaround was like, you know, 6 months, maybe less than 6 months to go from zero draft to published draft. So it was insane.
Yeah,
I still, especially considering how long the first draft takes me now, I still don't know how we did this. But I was like, yes, I want in. So I suddenly found myself with a book contract. And I literally Googled book agent horror because I wanted someone, I knew like this would be someone that I wanted to then work with, you know, on future books. And I found, it was like Publishers Marketplace wish list sort of thing. I found this guy who referenced Pet Sematary in his like wish list. And I was like, I love Pet Sematary. So I just reached out to him blindly. And I knew that the publishing house that he's with, or the agency that he's with rather, is a really great agency. He's with Writer's House, so I was like, okay, great, give him a try. Reached out to him coldly and said, I have a book contract with Tor, you know, with Macmillan essentially. He was like, great. We just kind of like felt each other out a little bit as people and realized that we liked each other. And he handled my book contract. And the reason why I go into all that is just because, like, on the surface, if I was just like, yeah, I got a book contract with Macmillan and Googled my agent, and then suddenly had a book agent, that would be like the most infuriating answer to that. And like sometimes I feel weirdly insecure about it. Kind of feels like I stumbled ass backwards into having representation. But there was a whole long, I'm sure
Right,
people
yeah.
listening to this at 1.5 to 2 times speed even feel the length of this story of like desperately wanting representation, trying to get representation, right, being a professional writer for like 15 years just in a different medium, but all
Yeah.
that experience then leading up to this moment, kind of like what we were talking about off mic already, of just like it takes this weird confluence of being ready but also having the stuff already put into it, already having the material to kind of
Yeah.
go forth, and then just like this random, you know, it's like three different mediums combining, you know, playwriting,
Yeah.
audio drama, and prose writing, all kind of combining just at the right time to suddenly be like, oh, okay, now I have an agent. And I also had this connection with Macmillan. And then they kind of started forming Nightfire at the same time that I was like, here are the next books that I want to work on. And it just kind of all, the timing all just kind of fed into this, you know, estuary of publishing.
Yeah,
For those
I love
listening, I'm making a lot of hand gestures.
that.
Yeah,
That no
so that's
one will
my,
ever appreciate.
no one will, just you and me.
Okay.
But yeah, so that's the long, knotty story about how I got representation.
I do love that because I think that, there is, we typically see just like the success side of it, right? We don't see, every overnight success is 20 years in the making, right? Yeah. We just had Steve Barry on the show, and he had said that, there's a lot of luck in the business, but if you're persistent, you will find the luck. Like, it's not just this magical thing that either happens, in a snap or doesn't, that, if you just keep sort of running your race, you will find the luck.
Exactly. And sometimes that is cold comfort when it's like really frustrating and you haven't found it yet, but it's so true. And then like if I would say inevitably when you do like find that cranny in the wall that like brings it all open, then it all kind of feels inevitable. But at the time, it is, yeah, it's just like that horrible existential feeling of like, where is the opening? My route to film and TV representation was the exact same way. And similarly, like, you know, years and years and years and years and years of nothing, and then like the most absurd ingress into
Yeah.
suddenly having representation. It's like what they put it on like motivational posters and mugs
Right.
and stuff like
Yes.
that of like luck is opportunity plus
Yep.
preparedness or something like that. But it's
Yeah.
true.
It is true.
It's
Yeah.
annoyingly true.
I know. And no one wants it to be true, but it is. So.
Because we also all know at least like one or two people that just like woke up one day and they're like, I'm going to write a book. And then suddenly
Oh.
it
Yeah.
all comes raining down on them. And that's the one case we look at. And we're
We don't
like,
talk about them,
oh,
Matt. We don't.
yeah, they're out
No,
there, but we
they
don't talk
can't
about
sit
them.
with us.
They're not as cool. They don't have the salty scars that we do.
Right. Yeah. So, I'm kind of curious, because every writer always has their own process and how they, tackle a book. And I'm just kind of wondering, like, what screenplay and playwright taught you about how to structure a book? Are there any similarities? Are they completely different?
You know, it's a great question, and it feels like every book always feels like you're starting from zero again,
Right.
like
Yes.
to borrow a phrase I've already said. But it is really true that every book kind of teaches you how to write it, like from scratch. So every time I think I'm like, ah, I've learned the lessons now. I've figured this out. I know how to apply all the things I know to this story. Inevitably, like 20,000-30,000 words into the next first draft, I'm like, I don't know how to write a book at all.
Right.
Like, I am completely
I have
at
no memory
sea.
Of this place.
Right. Like, how does anyone do this? Have I ever done this before? I'm 90,000 words into my next first draft, and I'm very much feeling that feeling. But I have, over the course of doing this a few times now, and having done it dozens of times as a playwright, and as a screenwriter, and you know, kind of a spec TV writer, I have noticed that there are things that I keep coming back to, lessons I keep coming back to that feel very important and feel like things, even if I'm not remembering them in the moment, they're like starting to be ingrained sort of muscle memory. And a lot of them, I think, come down to economy and use. Like every scene, ideally every paragraph, every sentence has to be serving some use. Like that's ultimately, I think, the lesson I keep coming back to. And just talking about like lessons learned as a playwright or as a screenwriter, those really get drilled into your head. Screenwriting, you know, especially when you're doing it under the auspices of a production that is going to be happening, or like someone is paying you to write something, that really gets drilled into your head because they're like, you know, here's our budget. We can't do that. We can't do this. This needs to go. That needs to go. That needs to be changed. I once used to work with like to even say indie film seems to make it seem like there was a lot of assets behind this film. It was like beyond indie film. It was bare bone filmmaking. But he would always get like a lot of overseas distribution. And that's where he would start his screenplays. He would start from where the overseas distributors wanted a movie to have. So it'd be like, they want this kind of scene, this kind of scene, this kind of scene. And then he would just like stitch together a script. So he was just like literally playing to order in a very like modular way. So if you ever wrote for him, like it just became like, you know, I need to do these things somehow.
Right. Yeah.
And like thread a story through it. Even more than that, like I think playwriting is what taught me in like a very real sense, because with playwriting, you can kind of do anything as long as you can like gesture towards it. Like, you know, you can say like, I'm writing a dragon now. And if it's an indie play, like you might not have the budget to build a dragon, but you have the audience kind of blessing to do that. And they'll go with you. Like it's a very malleable sort of art form, but it's also like only something that the human body can do, that the human voice can do. Like you're grounded by like character, and you're grounded by circumstances. You know, it has to be a story that can be communicated to someone in a short amount of time. And so those kind of skills, I think, really start paying dividends when you start trying to like write for things like suspense and dread and terror and excitement, you know, the kind of visceral things that you really want your horror story, which is what I write, to pay off. And so I will constantly, even if it's a really turgid first draft, when I go back to it, I'll constantly be thinking of those like playwrighty things of like, you know, where can I just find the like people in a room with a ticking bomb sort of skills? Where can I bring those to the fore again and use them to like trim away? I remember when I first started writing books, feeling like this giddy new toy feeling of like, I can just, if I want to communicate what a character is thinking, I can just say what the character is thinking. Like I don't have to like find a way to articulate it. And then annoyingly, I started to realize that like, yeah, but it's still like better to find a way to like actively communicate these things. So like the principles always kind of come down to, how can you make it active? How can you make it economical? And how can you make it worth people's time? I think that's also like a big thing I come back to over and over again, is how can I make it worth the reader's time? And how can I, you know, even though I'm not really writing for stage anymore, I will never lose that feeling of, if I'm going to create a character, if I'm going to write, you know, a scene or something like that, someone's got to show up to be in that role. Someone's got to like, you know, memorize these lines. Someone's got to book a space. So there's just always this feeling of like, it's got to be worth that. It's got to be worth this effort and time. So even if it's on the page, just like a, you know, a motel owner who has like two lines, there's always a part of me that's like, well, it's got to be at least a memorable two lines. It's got to be, it's got to be worth something. It can't just be, just because it's for free when you're writing it doesn't mean it's not going to cost somebody something. So make it worth at least a, at least like a moment of something.
Well, I definitely think you do that in your books.
Thank you.
They're very memorable for any number of reasons.
Thank you very much.
Where did the idea for When the Wolf Comes Home stem from?
Came from a couple of places. No surprise, given the compound sentences of most of my answers. It was, for anyone who is a fan of my first book, Mary, and has read the like wraparound material for that, knows that I first started writing that book when I was 13. A very early, precocious, again, version of that book when I was 13.
Aggressively precocious.
When the Wolf Comes Home was actually the book I started writing after that. So I wrote Mary, like, you know, wrote in quotation marks. It was like 100 pages and it was absolute drivel. But like I wrote it. 13-year-old me could be proud that I wrote it. The book I started writing next was what would eventually become When the Wolf Comes Home. Totally different, except for like the bare skeleton kind of premise of little boy on the run from angry dad winds up under the care of this kind of slacker woman, and they wind up on the run as the dad is chasing them. Like, that was it. Like, all the stuff that makes When the Wolf Comes Home what it actually is did not come until much, much later. But that story was inspired by, I can kind of pin it down to one very real point of inspiration, which was there was a television show, I believe on ABC, called American Gothic, which ran for a season with the great Gary Cole as a bad guy for a change. And I think Lucas Black played the boy. Didn't watch the show at the time. I was more into like X-Files and stuff like that, but I think it was trying to like ride the X-Files wave of like, you know, spooky TV. It was the promo for that show that did it. It was a 30-second TV spot. I've since watched it many times on YouTube just to like confirm that it was what was seared into my brain. And my memory of it was 100% accurate. But it was just like this little boy on the run, and it seemed like his dad or like a father figure was chasing him. And there was this voice that just kept repeating over and over again, "Someone's at the door, someone's at the door, someone's at the door." And it was just so spooky. And so like that was what kind of started that, that imagining, bubbling, whatever you want to call it. Down that road of like, oh, I want to write something about a little boy who's being chased by his father. And, you know, what then fed into that seed, the watering of that seed was I was also obsessed with Terminator 2. And I was a big fan of like Dean Koontz books. And I think, you know, again, as a Stephen King obsessive, the book Rose Matter had also like just come out, which is also like a chase novel. So it was like all of those things. I knew I wanted to write a chase, and I wanted it to be like Terminator 2, and I wanted it to be like American Gothic's TV spot, and I wanted it to be like Rose Matter, and I wanted it to be like Watchers or Twilight or, you know, those great Dean Koontz sort of chasey novels. And that kind of, so like it had just been like germinating since then. And then after I'd written my last book, Nestlings, which was very, you know, it was like 70s urban paranoia kind of potboilery sort of vibes. Every time I write a new book, I want it to be kind of a different flavor or a different, like, different tropes. I want to experiment with different tropes. And so I was like, okay, I've written, like, my unreliable narrator, ghosty, weird book with Mary, and I've written my, like, Rosemary's Baby, Salem's Lot ebook with Nestlings. What is the diametric opposite of that? Oh, okay, an 80s novel that's like a, you know, balls to the wall action horror surreal kind of garish high body count. And so it was just like this premise that has been with me for almost as long as Mary has been. I was like, oh, I can finally, like, I can get that out of my head, I can pull that thorn out of my brain,
right?
And no longer feel that itch. So yeah, that's the long and short of where this, you know, very strange, book, as anyone who's read it, I'm sure will agree, very strange, action-packed sort of Baroque horror.
Yeah, but still very, yeah, and memorable. You write in the end of your novels, you know, sort of like these author notes, I suppose. And in this one, you had talked about, you know, how a lot of your novels have a touch of the personal in them. Not in obvious ways, but and I'm always curious when it comes to especially people who write very violent horror and very emotional horror, how you separate you know, that as you're writing. How do you protect, you know, your mental health and your personal space while also bleeding on the page?
Yeah. Oh, that's a beautiful question. Beautiful way to put it. And I'm tempted to say I don't. You know, like I'm tempted to say,
fair enough.
Yeah, or maybe this is the protecting. Like, I find horror as a genre, for whatever medium, I find it to be a survival tool. I find it to be something very, I want to say cathartic, but cathartic almost feels like too flippant a word because it's not like a purgative. I don't like write these things and then feel like, that the trauma that I was exploring is now gone. If anything, like it kind of keeps it fresh, but it keeps it fresh in a way that makes it dealable, I think.
Yeah.
If that's a word,
it is now.
It is now. Yeah. Well, for it'll do. There's for me, horror is a way, and it kind of even goes back to you know, the writer origin stories again, because another one of the ways that like I got into macabre stuff was my mom was also a huge Stephen King fan. She was a huge kind of reader in general. And, you know, we're talking now like the late 80s, early 90s and stuff like that, when I was kind of coming online as a conscious sort of entity. So she would like be reading the paperback horror novels and sci-fi novels of that era. So like I have very clear memories of her getting mad at me when she was trying to read Jurassic Park, which had just come out in hardcover. And I like was like, I don't know, 6 years old or something like that, and being a 6 year old. And she was like, no, leave me alone. I'm reading about dinosaurs. And Stephen King was like, had a vaunted place on our bookshelves of like, these are the Stephen King, these are mom's Stephen King books. And she said I could read them when I'm ready for them, whenever I deem that to be. But she doesn't have time to deal with my nightmares, so I better be ready for them. So like, it was just like, it was always in the air growing up. And my mom was a single mom, single working mom with MS. So she had a progressive debilitating disease. She could only work part-time because of that disease. You know, her health was always kind of hanging over us and like its inevitable deterioration. She couldn't do a lot of things that like a lot of other moms could do. And also just economically, we couldn't do a lot of things that other kids in our peer groups were doing. We kind of lived outside of my school district, like kind of isolated. And like I often say we didn't grow up on the wrong side of the tracks, but we kind of grew up on the tracks. Like we could see the wrong side of the tracks, just on the other side of the intersection. So there just like wasn't a lot, and there was a lot of like reminders of very tenuous, heavy things. You know, she's also second generation American. Like her mom came from Poland right before the war, and we're Jewish, and so we have like a lot of family members that were lost in the Holocaust, and she was always kind of obsessed with that. It felt very close to her, temporally speaking. So like she was just always kind of digging into the whys and things like that of that huge atrocity. So all of which is to say, like, these were really heavy things that were just like hanging over us as a little household with my mom and my brother and me. But I knew even at a very early age, she used these stories. She used Stephen King. She used Michael Crichton and Dean Koontz and Anne Rice and you know, all of those kind of writers to metabolize these things and to also communicate to my brother and I when we were old enough to kind of fall into these stories as well. My brother kind of fell more in love with fantasy and sci-fi, and I fell more in love with horror. But the principle was still the same. Like, life was really heavy and hard and scary for us. And we would use these stories. Again, like, it feels pat to say it's escapist, because it wasn't escapist. It was it was giving us a filter to sort of process these emotions, these these tropes of loss, of you know, societal collapse, of the failures of the body and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. They allowed us to sort of deal with these stories, and at once to, like, you know, again, this also feels like a very Jewish thing to say in a way, but like, we could always be like, well, it could be worse, you know, at least at least that's not happening. But it could also be like, yeah, people feel these feelings, and so we're feeling it too, and either they survive or they don't survive. But each of these stories is like instructive in a way. Each of these stories like shows us how one can survive, or the mistakes one makes that makes them not survive. And so, to bring it back to your question, I apologize. I like to ramble. But to bring it back to your question, like, when I'm then like writing something that feels like it's very bleedy on the page, as you say, like, it's kind of, in a way, my way of saying, like, it's putting it back through that filter that I've had from a very young age of just like, you know, I can't write something. I don't even think I'm imaginative enough to write something that doesn't feel like it's at least like 1 foot in whatever I'm dealing with. Cause like, it's, if I'm gonna be dealing with this thing, I might as well like make it useful. I might as well put it to work, you know?
Right, exactly.
But so if that's the case, it's gonna have to go into these tropes anyway. And it's gonna have to, I'm gonna have to learn as I'm writing this book, you know, how I'm processing X tragedy, X trauma. And yeah, so like, it doesn't feel like there's like a protection per se. If anything, it feels like it's like, you know, I'm gonna throw one more motivational poster cliche against the wall, but like, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant in a way.
Right,
so it's just like, okay, like, this is heavy, ugly stuff that I'm dealing with, or that I'm investigating.
Open.
Let's just rip it open, exactly, and like, one of the most amazing things I've experienced as a writer is hearing from readers who are like, I have felt this way too, or like, this book meant so much to me because of this. In that sort of community comes, I think, as close to a sort of catharsis as we can get. I think when you hear from other people and you're like, yeah, you get it too. And like, this is hard and isolating and lonely, but like, but also not, like, when you find the people who know what you're talking about.
I love that. I mean, I could talk to you for, I mean, hours and hours. You're very easy to talk to. I'm very
because my answers are very long.
But they're fun. But we do like to close out with the same question, which is, what is one piece of advice you would give to newer aspiring writers?
I think it would be to just write. Like, just, it sounds so easy and simplistic and almost insultingly obvious, but just even like the surface that we've touched on in this conversation so far, I think, I hope that can at least like put some proof to that of just I remember, because I, again, aggressively precocious, I used to read like Writer's Digests, like the Writer's Digests and like things like that as a kid, even though I like never even attempted publishing. But like, I just wanted to read the, like, the marketplace for some reason. But I was reading some like book of quotations, writer quotations, when I was like, you know, I don't know, 12, 13 or something like that. And there was one that, I don't remember who it was attributed to, but it was, if you wish to be a writer, write. And it was just so simple and it was so no duh, but it has stuck with me for a reason, because like, yeah, like, if this is what you want to do, just do it.
Do
like,
it.
Let it be like, I don't want to say bad words, but let it be awful. Like, trust that it's awful. It should be awful. The first draft should be terrible. And don't let that stop you. Just write it out. Come back to it. Keep writing. Keep doing it. Like, if you want to be a writer, just write. You don't need permission. You can do it.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for your time. I know that our listeners are going to enjoy this as much as I have. And I can't wait for you to write another book so you can come back and tell me all about Shakespeare and Stephen King.
That the book I'm currently writing right now is my homage to like kids on bikes and stuff. Like I'm writing about 10-year-olds right now, but set
Awesome.
today, and it is all about Shakespeare and Stephen King and other things. So we'll have to talk about it next
Yeah, so
time.
stay tuned.
Yeah, if I finish it.
This was such a fun interview. He is so fun to talk to.
I know. I love this interview. It was so good. I think aggressively precocious is, I think I need a shirt with that on, just like some kid stabbing their desk while their teachers are studying Shakespeare.
I'm just liking the idea of thinking of Shakespeare as a horror writer.
Yeah. Well, I want to hear that argument.
He kind of was.
Yeah. I know that he gets like, you know, attributed, I think, with a lot, but his stories are pretty brutal. I mean, even, you know, Romeo and Juliet, are not a romance. It's a tragedy.
Yeah.
But
I wonder if he caught flack for just jumping genres like we would in today's world. Because he really was all over the place.
That's true.
I don't think so. I know. I'd have to look. I know. We'll have to have a whole separate conversation about Shakespeare. But Shakespeare and Stephen King, since we're talking about it, obviously played a key role in Nat's writing experience. Who were some of your earliest writing influences? I'm assuming no one except Nat and my husband were reading Shakespeare in first grade because of sadistic teachers.
Oh, like all the way back
maybe
to
I'm
first
wrong.
Grade? What were we reading?
Oh, or boy. Just anywhere along the line.
I grew up reading like the earliest books that had the biggest influence on me were the Encyclopedia Brown books, which I actually kind of joke around a lot sometimes that like my Dan Cotler character is basically a grown up Encyclopedia Brown. Then there was like, you know, Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing. That was a great book, you know. So the whole, everyone read Judy Blume and Beverly Clary. Yeah.
Where the Sidewalk Ends. Like
yeah. Is it Clary?
Everyone
read those. No one remembers their name, apparently. But,
yeah. This is so basic, but it's the truth. So when I was probably 8 or 9 years old, I read The Hobbit. And that was one of my earliest influences. I love that.
That makes a lot of sense for you.
Yeah. Well, I do love being cozy and snacks. So, you know, it fits my personality.
There's a fit. That tracks, yeah. I didn't read that until ninth grade, but the biggest influence on my writing career was Orson Scott Card and specifically Ender's Game, which
that makes a lot of sense.
Was the first time I'd read a book and thought, a human wrote this, and I'm a human. You know? So,
well, I didn't want to be a writer until much, much later. And then it was Mervyn Peake was a big influence. I loved Gorman Gost. All that weird fantasy, China Mieville. Hi, Jenna's husband. I don't know. I loved all that stuff.
I started with the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew mysteries only because we bought them at a yard sale and got like the complete set. We'd been hitting the library before that, but those were the first like what I felt were real books that I read. Like the rest were probably kids books leading up to that. Then I tackled a ton of Charles Dickens. I like fell in love with Charles Dickens. I never really liked Shakespeare, you know, like I've read them all, but like only because I was like forced to do it in school.
I
feel like I need to go back and revisit it. Like I didn't get it back in the day when I was supposed to read it.
As a ninth grader, I hated it too, JD. So you're not alone. I'm like, why are we reading it?
Really?
Wait, yeah. So Jenna, you're the one who's on record officially for hating classic literature.
Shakespeare? Don't. No.
Wait a minute.
No.
Wait a minute.
No.
Is this a Mandela effect?
Shakespeare is not the same. Shakespeare is like worlds above everyone else. And the reason I don't like classic literature is because the language is so dull. But Shakespeare, because he plays with language and because he's doing so many things at the same time. And I'm sure someone can say Dickens does the same thing, but I don't get bored when I read Shakespeare. I also think that, you know, because Shakespeare is quite dark and quite violent, and he just knows so much. Like, if you want to understand, like, human nature, like, Shakespeare, it's just so timeless. And you can read a Shakespeare novel and or a play, and this is one of the things, and this is true. People who study him will say, like, in an audience during the time, no one knew what, like, both sides of an argument, a political aisle, all of it. They all thought he was writing to them, which I think is what makes him so fascinating and so
Yeah.
interesting to read, because you don't know what side he's on. You don't
Yeah.
know who is necessarily supposed to be the good one or the bad one. And I think those things really have always fascinated me, and I think are very interesting. And I don't know, other classic literature books, just I get that they try to do the same thing, but it's just so distant and hard to get to, and it
Yeah.
just isn't as accessible to me. And I know Shakespeare's not accessible to a lot of people, but I'm a weirdo. What can I
I think
say?
mine was just like my attention. I need to go back and read it again because it was just the reading speed was so slow for me as a 15-year-old. I was like, screw this. This is too much work.
Yeah.
Yeah, the first time I read Shakespeare, I think, was in like ninth grade, but I remember being fascinated by it. I did like Great Expectations. I did like Miss Havisham. She was a great character. I did.
Well, what were you reading before Shakespeare?
So, man, I probably start like, God, I don't know. I was the first, like, earliest memories I have of reading was a lot of Roald Dahl. So I read a lot of that. I read a lot of the Nancy Drew and then the Hardy Brothers in the library, because the library is the one place I could go by myself and just
Yeah.
check out a bunch of books. So yeah, I like plowed through all of those. I think in like fifth and sixth grade, maybe the Babysitter's Club. I remember those. Those were big.
Yeah.
And then I snuck into the young adult section and was like a big fan of the Sweet Valley. What was it? Sweet Valley
Oh,
High?
I remember
Sweet
those.
Valley
My
High.
friend had all of those. I stole a few of
Yeah.
them. I read a couple of those.
Yeah, just nothing but like
Choose Your Own Adventure. That was my
high level
guilty
drama.
pleasure.
Oh, I
Those
did
were good
read
too.
one of
When I was a
those.
kid. Very good.
But a lot of those, like Where the Red Fern Grows, what a, the Indian
Yeah.
in the Cupboard, that one was a
Oh, I
good
read that.
one.
Yeah. See, all these books I've forgotten my childhood, and now you're just bringing it all back up.
Hatchet,
That was a good book.
yeah.
Yeah.
There was a book I read called Five Boys in a Cave that is not something anybody knows. Like, it's not a book anyone's ever heard of. But I actually remembered that book so fondly that I actually tracked down a copy of it years, a few years back because I just had this abiding memory of it,
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so there's a lot of books like that, a lot of stories like that that I read that I couldn't even tell you who wrote them, what the characters' names were. They're just this vague story that stuck around in my head and influenced a lot of what I write. And that was one of them. So,
Yeah,
Five
it's just
Boys in
so
a Cave.
funny how that happens.
Yeah.
Shapes you. I like that he talked about how his playwriting created a lot of the tenets of writing, which I think everyone eventually comes to, which is economy, use, grounded in character and circumstance. You can add a fantasy setting, but you really do have to focus on those tenets. Where do you think you guys like learned that skill along the way? Was it just writing a lot, or is it something that came naturally to you?
I got it just from reading so much, like just
Yeah.
constantly reading, like that framework is just ingrained in me. But I really do think because I've talked to a lot of playwrights and they seem to really have it dialed in when it comes to crafting a novel. There's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, if you're going to write a play, like every single word has to count, every action has to count. Like you can't waste anybody's time, whether it's the actor or the audience. And I think you're conscious of that the entire time you're writing a play. So like even more so than writing a screenplay, like if you're doing a stage play. So I think once if you're able to get good at that, like that's like the holy grail. And then, I don't want to say you have to dumb it down for a novel, but like it's easier to write a novel than it is to write a screenplay. And it's definitely easier to write or it's easier to write a novel than a stage play. Yeah.
Yeah. Why do you think that the playwriting is so much more focused on that than a screenplay? I'm curious.
Well, with a screenplay, you can get away with other action. You can have other things happening, but like a stage play, it's almost all dialogue or very, limited, tiny little snippets of action that take place, but everything is just more and more focused. And that's one of the reasons why I think so many stage plays have made fantastic movies. because they're completely dialed in. And you know, not only that, but like because they get performed over and over, like they tweak it over and over using an audience reaction to determine what's working and what's not working. So you take a stage play, you let it go through that cycle on Broadway or someplace for a couple of years, it literally gets, perfected, and then they can take it and turn it into a movie, and that movie is going to be fantastic.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. Do you experiment with different tropes in each novel?
I have been, but mainly to try and branch out and expand my audience. Like I'm working on a sci-fi novel with Kevin. Flatliners is, medical and also sci-fi. So I'm trying to branch out just to grab readers from places that may not know who I am at this point.
That's fun. Christine, Kevin, do you play with tropes?
Oh, I write too many genres, so I don't know in terms of tropes. I mean, I try to be conscious of that, about what would be expected and how can I do it differently. I like those when they do those memes on social media about reverse tropes, which like the bed is too big. Like
Yeah, that's
I'm
funny.
like, we should actually try and write some of those. That would be very funny. Like a divorce
That would be
pact. I see
funny.
them for romance all the time. They're like divorce pact. I'm like, yes, that would be
Right, yeah.
hilarious. So I was like, oh, how would that apply to my genre? So I do try to think about those.
I had a conversation with an author who's writing romantic comedies, and we kind of got on this sort of tangent, but I realized the tropes of romantic comedy are actually very pliable. Like you could put those in almost any book, and you could make that book not a romantic comedy on its own, because if you throw it in a horror novel, it's still a horror novel. But there's things you can do that actually liven up the characters. So it's like a Swiss Army knife of characterization, I think, to have
Like
those.
genre blending. I like genre blending. I think that's fun.
I like reading genre blends. So there you go.
Yeah, see?
All right. Very cool. With that, JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got Joanna Penn coming on. Joanna is a New York Times bestseller and USA Today bestseller of the Arcane Thriller series. She's also the host of the long-running podcast, The Creative Pen. She recently updated her craft book, How to Write Nonfiction, and she's going to be here to tell us what's changed. Joanna Penn.
Sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.